Okay, so the first lecture today is meant to be a kind of scene-setting lecture. I've called it a post-war scene. I want to say just a little bit about the nature of this module and how it's sort of organised in terms of the historical period. So we will be covering basically the last 50 years of the 20th century. And obviously, therefore, we're going to start in the sort of late 40s, early 50s. Your first text, Malcolm Lowry's Under the Volcano, was published in 1947. But I thought it would be useful contextual information to just try and paint a little picture of the post-war scene. The module is called The Sense of an Ending, which is a kind of slightly ambiguous title. And what I think we might discover as we go through the module is that there are lots of endings. There are a few beginnings as well, but there are lots of endings. There's, for example, starting today, the fairly obvious one, the end of the war. 1945, the end of the Second World War, obviously a very, very significant date. That produced all kinds of effects which we will which we'll go on to consider. One of them is the acceleration of the end of empire, for example. So that's another kind of ending. The ending later on, maybe in the 70s, of what we're usually called the post-war consensus, and I'll say something about that in a minute, and so on. So there are lots of endings which we'll consider. But I want to start by just sort of winding the clock back to 1945. So in 1945, Britain has endured 6 years of war, as has the rest of Europe, and like the rest of Europe, Britain is in a bit of a state. That picture shows sort of a very, very kind of evocative picture. Shows people browsing amongst the books of the London Library, but you can see that the library has had a bit of redecoration by the bombs. But I suppose it's a kind of Spirit of the Blitz sort of picture, you know, Britain will carry on, that kind of thing. So these gents with their bowler hats on are browsing through the very impressive collection of the London Library, and kind of illustrating a certain attitude, I think, which you got in Britain in 1945. And I think we need to just pause a bit and think about what 1945 meant. Obviously, it meant the end of the war, great relief all round, but it meant also a period of incredibly intensive rebuilding, sort of literal rebuilding, because lots of cities had suffered, and also the kind of rebuilding of society in terms of its institutions, its organisations. You've also got a lot of soldiers coming back from active service who perhaps are more demanding of what they want from the country than they might have been had there not been a war. So one of the endings that we might consider as we go along through the module is this idea of the class system and the challenges to that the late 20th century put forward. So there's a lot, I think, about the historical context that we need to take on board. So yes, okay, ending of war means a new beginning, a new start after the war. And what happened after the war is there was an election, 1945, and rather to some people's surprise, I think particularly Winston Churchill's surprise, it was a Labour landslide. They had a huge majority, the biggest they've ever had, before or since, and Clement Attlee, the leader of the Labour Party, became Prime Minister. And things changed very rapidly in Attlee's time. And I suppose, you know, what's important is not just the rapid pace of change, but also the radical nature of the change. So, for example, the National Health Service was established under Attlee's government, and you might have an opinion on where we are now with the National Health Service, but the idea of a National Health Service was something which developed immediately after the war and was implemented then. Other sorts of national ideas. Before the war, we had a system with railways, for example, where they were all owned by private companies. What a ridiculous idea, you might think. Yes, and so they were nationalised after Attlee got into power. He also nationalised the coal mines, he also nationalised the steel industry and various other aspects of industry. The Education Act, which had been proposed in 1944, was fully implemented, and that meant the raising of the school leaving age. It meant the establishment of a system of schooling across the country, which was much more modern and much more comprehensive in every sense of that word. So things were changing very, very quickly, and not just in terms of kind of the physical rebuilding of the country, but also in terms of the way in which the country was organised, the way in which society was organised. And that went on. I mean, the interesting thing, I think, is that the kind of system that was established under that government carried on pretty much for about 30, 35 years afterwards, until really the Thatcher era. And what's interesting, I think, is that Attlee's government fell in 1951. He was replaced as Prime Minister by Churchill. But Churchill didn't actually change that much. And as I say, it was not until the Thatcher era that a lot of those kinds of ideas, for example, the nationalisation of various industries, were reversed. So what we have after the war is what's often referred to as a post-war consensus. In other words, the parties, yes, they have their differences, yes, they have, you know, different nuances in terms of their policies and so on, but largely there's kind of broad agreement on what government should do, how it should organise things, how it should run the country. So the kind of polarisation that you get in the Thatcher era didn't really exist. So we've got, you know, very much this thought of a new start. Things are changing, things are getting different. There's a new atmosphere in the country. So I want to say a little bit about sort of cultural developments, and also then move on to say a bit more about what happens after the 1950s. Because obviously I want to give you a kind of overview of where we're going on this module. You'll notice that the texts that we're looking at are arranged chronologically, so that, you know, we will be sort of going through this period almost kind of decade by decade. Okay, so literary developments. A decline of the kind of experimental literature that's characterised by modernism. Joyce and Wolfe are both dead by 1941. Hurrah, says several people. Pound, he's not dead, but he might as well be, because he's incarcerated as a madman and spends his time writing his interminable cantos. So a different kind of literature begins to emerge, I think. And so modernism as a movement, if you could ever define it as a movement, seems to fade away, and other things take its place. And I just want to mention a few of those things, some of which we'll be revisiting during the module. So you get some very strongly political novels. Animal Farm, for example, in 1984 by Orwell. Animal Farm, I'm sure most people will have come across this. On one level, it's about pigs. and donkeys and so on. On another level, it's a very stinging critique of the Soviet Union and the communist system that existed in the Soviet Union at the time. Orwell's other major novel of this period, and he was going to die a few years later anyway, 1984, which was a kind of reversal of 1948, which is when he wrote it, is, as I'm sure most of you know, a dystopian vision of the future in which the world is divided into three apparently totalitarian states who are constantly at war with each other, and it features the efforts of a kind of everyman figure called Winston Smith. The name is significant, you know, he's borrowed Winston off Winston Churchill, and Smith is a kind of everyman sort of name. To fight the system, and of course, I hate to spoil the ending if you've not already read it, but he fails to overthrow the system. I noticed somebody said the other day, just read 1984. God, never realised things were so bad in those days. I think he was being ironic. I hope so. So that was you've got that strain coming out. You know, the novels which are not particularly about individuals but are about systems. Social comment seems to be coming to the fore. In poetry, you've got certainly by the time the 50s are in motion. You've got this kind of retreat from the experimental modernism that characterised the 20s and 30s, and you've got something which is much more like a return to form, if you like. So rhyme, metre, the kind of traditional ways of organising poetry seem to be coming to the fore again. And central figures such as Philip Larkin, Kingsley Amis, Donald Davey, D.G. Enright, Elizabeth Jennings, these are the sort of people who were significant then, and we'll look at some of their poems later on in the module. A couple of other things that are significant, I think, in the 50s, in the aftermath of the war, the emergence of regional novelists, particularly novelists from the north of England, broadly defined. Silito, Alan Silito, actually comes from Nottingham, but, you know, if you're part of the London literati, that might as well be Iceland. To us it's south, of course, but to them it's the north. So Silito was writing novels such as The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning at the end of the 50s, beginning of the 60s. John Wayne, spelt like that, not like the cowboy. His novels covered similar sort of territory. Best known for a novel called Hurry On Down. Keith Waterhouse, again part of that school, and his most famous novel of that time was Billy Liar, probably. And many of these were made into films, which again is another aspect of culture that we might touch upon. Those films were characterised by their sort of gritty realism quite often, which was something new, something perhaps borrowed from European cinema, but something a bit new in British cinema. Drama, you've got two very interesting and very different strands, it seems to me, that are worth thinking about. The way in which British drama had developed in the 30s, 40s, was very much a kind of upper middle class presentation of life. So, you know, the kind of typical scene would be some drawing room, you know, with bookcases and French windows through which somebody dressed in a tennis outfit would arrive, that kind of thing. And then you got John Osborne in 1956 writing his play Look Back in Anger, which defined a new sort of realistic kind of drama which dealt with working class issues and dealt with society at large, sometimes labelled kitchen sink, because you know, you might have scenes that are set in a kitchen, which would be anathema to, you know, the kind of writers like Terence Rattigan or Noel Coward who came before. So people like Osborne, people like Arnold Wesker, those are the people who were writing that kind of drama, very British sort of strain of drama in the 50s, revolutionary in its time. The other thing that's going on is a sort of avant-garde strain of drama, perhaps best exemplified by Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot, which is 1952, I think, when it's first produced. Beckett, of course, was an Irishman who was exiled in France and actually wrote in French. He wrote Waiting for Godot, En attendant Godot, in French, and then translated it into English. And, you know, I'm sure lots of you will know Godot. It's the rather bizarre story of two tramps, possibly, or clowns, possibly, depending on which sort of production you see, who are involved in an interminable wait for Godot. And they're spoiled the ending. Godot never makes it. He's just not there. So they're waiting forever. It's a kind of metaphor for life, I think. You know, that they are waiting for something to happen and it doesn't happen. So that sort of drama. There's also a British strain of that, really, that comes out in the 50s, sometimes referred to as absurdist drama. So writers like N.F. Simpson, and plays like One Way Pendulum, which was 1958, those are prominent in the 50s. All of this taking part against a background of cultural developments, which are, I think are worth mentioning. One of the things that the post-war government planned as a kind of statement of, you know, to say that Britain is back, you know, we've recovered from the war, was the 1951 Festival of Britain, the logo for which is on the front of your handbook. And the Festival of Britain is, you know, it's a cultural festival. That was when the Festival Hall on the South Bank in London was built. It was built for the festival, hence its name. And it was, you know, it was a statement about culture. It was a statement that said, you know, we are a cultural nation and we are investing both financially and in terms of effort into culture. A couple of other things that are perhaps worth pointing out. 1955, the launch of ITV. Up until that point, you've got one television channel, BBC, and up until the coronation in 1953 of our dear Queen, most people didn't have a television. Very expensive bit of kit, and people just couldn't afford it. But they made an effort, and you've probably seen pictures of, you know, hundreds of people crowded round a tiny 10-inch black and white screen, watching grainy pictures of Queen Elizabeth receiving the crown. So television expands rapidly in the 1950s to the point where in 1955 we have a commercial channel for the first time. So your viewer is absolutely swamped with choice because they can watch BBC or ITV. Assuming, actually, that they can receive ITV in the part of the country where they live, because I'm saying 1955, actually, ITV wasn't fully introduced across the country until 1959. I think if you lived in the northeast, you were the last to get it. The other thing I'm mentioning there is Richard Hoggart's The Uses of Literacy. This was an interesting sociological study, if you like. Hoggart was, I suppose, what we would now call a kind of cultural theorist, although I don't think that sort of job title existed then. He more or less invented this idea of the study of popular culture. He founded a centre for the study of contemporary culture at Birmingham University. And this book, The Uses of Literacy, takes as its starting point the idea that this is the first generation where you've got kind of mass literacy, at least basic literacy. Everybody can read and write, more or less. And what's happening to that group of people? And the thing that he examines, really, is the erosion of a sort of indigenous British culture, which he feels is being attacked from without, attacked by largely American culture. So things like the dance band music of the day, that kind of thing, he finds, you know, is eroding the native culture. And it's a rather, well, it's very much of its time, and we'll look at an extract from it in class. But it's a very interesting document because it kind of encapsulates that period in time when these changes were coming through. And he's particularly scathing about teenage culture. These teenagers, you remember being a teenager, I don't, so long ago, but these teenagers would apparently go to milk bars and coffee bars, which were just emerging at the time. And they would stay there for ages, playing music on jukeboxes, apparently. And Hoggart finds this, you know, deeply immoral, and should be stopped immediately, and they should actually be singing folk songs and dancing around the maypole instead. And that's one extreme, really. I suppose the other extreme is somebody like Colin McInnes, who I've mentioned in the middle there. McInnes, writing in London in the late 50s, a series of novels which chronicled young life at the time, the best known of which is Absolute Beginners, which was made into a film in the 1980s. So in terms of literature then, it's an interesting time. You've got all these different developments, but they don't really link up. You know, there aren't kind of any strong movements. When we talk about periods in literature, as we do, of course, we talk about the Romantic era, the Renaissance, and so on, there isn't really something which makes these things cohere in the way that you could say in, say, the Romantic era. So lots of different threads to follow. A couple of other things that are happening at the time. Moving from now into the late 50s, early 60s, the Cold War has a big influence on how people think, how politics works, and it has a kind of knock-on effect in literature too. So after the war, you've got that kind of realignment of Europe. The Soviet Union, of course, were allied with Britain and France and America in the war, and now, well, as Churchill says, an iron curtain has come down over Europe. And the iron curtain, in other words, is the borders of the Soviet Union. And of course, the Soviet Union is kind of vastly increased. So, you know, if we think about the map of Europe now, then most of the countries of Eastern Europe, you know, places like Poland, Bulgaria, and so on, are in the Soviet bloc. And are therefore more or less inaccessible to the West, and, you know, there's a kind of standoff which is exacerbated by the Soviets' acquisition of nuclear weapons. The key moment, of course, was the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, the Bay of Pigs episode, when, you know, we were quite close to nuclear war between Russia and America. So what happens really is that the overt war, you know, the mechanized military war, the Second World War, is replaced by what's characterized as the Cold War. So there is no official state of warfare between the Soviet bloc and the other Western European countries, but nonetheless, they are in opposition to each other. And it gives rise, actually, to a literary genre which still continues today, the spy novel, And some of the main practitioners out there, probably the first who really got to grips with this idea is Eric Ambler. But Graham Greene is probably more famous. And Ian Fleming, of course, the creator of James Bond. John le Carré is still going strong now, having published his first novels in, I think, 1960. And he's still going strong now. He published a new novel very recently. And of course, one of our texts, Tremor of Intent, is a kind of parody of those spy novels. A couple of other things to pick up on. The End of Empire. Even in 1945, if you look at the map of the world, then huge chunks of it are still coloured red or pink to signify they belong to the British Empire. And it still is the Empire in those days. The idea of the Commonwealth comes later. It's still the Empire. So if you look at that map of the world, huge tracts of land, the Indian subcontinent, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, large chunks of Southeast Asia, large chunks of Africa, and so on, are officially British. But starting with the major one, India in 1947, what this period sees is an increase, an acceleration in the process of what we might call decolonization. And that is exemplified in the granting of independence to lots of states who were formerly colonies of Britain. India is the first in 1947, partly as a result of Gandhi's campaign, but it's a very messy birth, if you like. India is partitioned, and so Pakistan is created. At the sort of top left and right of India, as it were, a state separated by another state coming in the middle of it, and of course later on East Pakistan secedes from Pakistan and becomes Bangladesh. So that was messy, and then through the 50s and 60s most of the former empire is reduced to states which are now members of the Commonwealth. They're given their own independence. Macmillan, who was Prime Minister at the time, went to South Africa, which was still under apartheid, and made a speech where he talked about the winds of change that were sweeping across Africa. And that was a kind of signal of intent, you know, is what was going to happen. So, End of Empire is significant. It changes Britain's place in the world. It changes the way that people think about Britain. It changes the way in the relationship between the former colonies and the home country. And Anita Desai's Clear Like Day, which is one of our novels, will examine some of that. I mentioned a little bit about youth culture. I suppose there's several factors, and this is kind of oversimplifying grotesquely, I think, but there are some factors which are worth mentioning. The first, which seems very strange to us, is the idea of full employment. I think one of the most significant things to say about that is what we would now call a job centre in those days, established by the Labour government after the war. They were called employment exchanges. Now, if you think about that, employment exchange. Now, if you're exchanging something, you're swapping it, aren't you? You're saying, I've got this thing, and I want to have that thing instead. And so this can only happen in a state where jobs are actually easy to come by. And, so if you're working at something and you don't like it very much, you go on to the employment exchange and say, what have you got? Oh, well, we've got this job here. Do you fancy that? Yes, okay, I'll do that. And as simple as that, almost. I'm exaggerating, obviously, but, you know, it's part of the effect, I think, of having full employment. Consequently, growing affluent, people have more disposable income. And also that kind of emergence of a distinctive teenage or youth culture, which hadn't really happened before. You've got, for the first time, that kind of definition of that group of people who are, I suppose, you know, kind of 15 to 22, something like that, that sort of group, who have their own sort of music, their own sort of look, their own sort of style, their own sort of places to hang out, coffee bars, dens of iniquity, produces their own kind of subculture. So, for example, in the 1950s, you get the emergence of the Teddy Boys, who wore a kind of a version of Edwardian costume, hence Teddy Boys, it's a short for Edwardian, and you know, various other subgroups as well. So that is reflected in several of the texts that we're going to look at. I'm going to say something very briefly for 5 minutes about the text, and then we'll finish. So there they are in chronological order, more or less. And just to say a little bit about each one, Malcolm Lowry's Under the Volcano is perhaps one that reflects back on the kind of literature that immediately preceded it. So it's a kind of hangover from modernism, if you like. Those of you who were delighted by Ulysses and Mrs. Dalloway taking place over 24 hours will be ecstatic to learn that Under the Volcano takes place over 12 hours and largely consists of kind of hallucinatory visions by an alcoholic consul in Mexico. Lots of laughs. The second one is Muriel Spark, which is very, very different. It's a short novel, comic novel, about a man who may or may not be the devil, and what sort of impact he had in a small community in London, Peckham Rye, at the end of the 50s. Burgess, who some of you will know is my kind of major subject, Burgess is Tremor of Intent, his novel written in 1966. Burgess was very keen. He actually wrote a screenplay for a James Bond film that was rejected. He was very keen on kind of writing about this sort of spy culture. And so this is his version of those mid-60s spy novels that were so prevalent. By complete contrast, Basil Bunting's Brick Flats is a long poem, which I think Bunting's a really interesting figure because he's writing well into the 1960s, but he's clearly a kind of modernist. You know, he's kind of related to Pound and Eliot and those sorts of people. And Brick Flats is partly an evocation of place, the place Brick Flats in the northeast, but also a sort of autobiographical poem too. Very fascinating and very very sort of knotty verse, you know, lots of things packed into it. Anissa Desai's Clear Light of Day is a novel which deals with the aftermath of empire. Anissa Desai is Indian, of course, and this is a novel which raises all those issues about the changing relationship of former colonies to the colonising nation. And we finish with Stoppard's Arcadia, which is typical Stoppard, very clever play, which deals with, I suppose it's a kind of State of Britain play, really. It's set partly in the present day, but partly looking back to a sort of version of Edwardian England, which is almost a kind of cliche, the kind of Downton Abbey version of England in Edwardian times, and examines the connotations of that sort of idea. We shall also look, as I said, at some poems by significant figures to give some ballast to all this prose. So It's very varied, I think, and the texts don't really have any kind of common denominators. So it will be a question, really, of approaching each one as a single text and obviously thinking about its context. But we can take, I think, at least one overarching view, and that's really based on what I just said about Arcadia, that a lot of our texts will say something about notions of Britishness, notions of nationality, notions about national identity, those sorts of things. And they will deal with that in their different ways.